Good afternoon. So last time we talked about reader-writer locks. You mentioned that, well, there's this very common pattern. Common, kind of like we saw the pattern we wanted for barriers was common. And like in the case with barriers, it was common enough that it warranted having sort of a specialized synchronization construct for it. And this pattern was we have some shared data and we have some data structure where we can safely have lots of threads read from the data structure at the same time, but we can't have threads reading while other threads are writing. Common reason for this might be like if we have a binary tree, we can't have threads trying to use pointers in that tree if they're going to be reallocated as they're reading them. So we need to make sure that modifications only happen when nothing else is going on, but we want to allow multiple readings to happen. And we could have used a lock to do this, a normal lock, but that would have the extra effect of only allowing one thread to read at a time. So instead we have this kind of extension of a lock called a reader-writer lock, where we have two types of lock operations. We have the write lock operation, which works like the locks we've seen before in that it waits for no one else to have the lock. We have this read lock operation where rather than it being exclusive, we can share that read lock with any number of other readers. And we saw that, you know, we could have implemented this instead of having it supplied to us in our threading library in terms of monitors. Maybe that wouldn't be as efficient as our threading library's implementation, but that would certainly have worked. And when we did so, we had some decisions to make. And this kind of illustrated sort of general ideas for how we would use monitors to accomplish things with, in terms of synchronization. And one of these decisions was, well, we have to decide between waking up readers and waking up writers in the case where we have both options. And if we decide that we're never going to wake up readers if there are writers available, it could be the case that, you know, we just have a big, you know, queue of writers, and readers never get to go. If we decide that we're going to have readers go preferentially, well, very commonly, we'll have readers all the time. In fact, if we do nothing about this, that might be sort of the typical case, because readers will overlap with each other, so we'll just never get to a point where we have zero readers, so a writer can go. And we saw a way we could deal with this as well. We would track information about how many active readers and writers and waiting readers and writers there were, and use that to adjust our conditions as far as when we waited and when we signaled readers or writers to go. And this sort of is the general thing we're going to do with monitors to implement different synchronization policies. After talking about reader-writer locks, we talked about deadlock. And we mentioned for deadlock that we have this sort of formal definition where we have these four requirements. We need mutual exclusion. We need to have some resources that when one thread took them, that would prevent other threads from accessing that resource. So with locks, you know, only one thread can have a normal lock at a time. This also is true of many other types of resources like memory or space in a buffer and so on. And this also says that if we ever have a deadlock situation and, well, we didn't actually need to share things, well, we can fix it by not sharing things, by having independent resources for each thread. We need to have this hold and wait property. So we need to have, while a thread is holding one resource, that it waits for something else. So if we disrupt either part of that, we're going to get rid of it. So if we never wait for resources, don't have to worry. Like if all we do is check if the resource is available and if it's not, we give up, that's fine. Or if once we've acquired a resource, we never acquire other resources, that would also solve the problem. So if we can acquire all our resources at once, we're not going to have a deadlock situation. Another criteria is that we can't have preemption of resources. So getting a resource is going to have to wait for the thread which actually has the resource to give it up, that we don't have some sort of mechanism to make the thread give it up. And we saw with compute time, we had preemption, meaning that if you're using the processor, the OS can preempt you, stop you from running, and make you give up the processor. And that means that we can't have deadlock with the processor. But that sort of solution, which works for the processor because we have this way of sort of giving you back the processor later on, doesn't really make sense for a lot of other resources. With a lock, we're like thinking of like a map, for example. I can't let you, finish your operation with the map later, but steal the lock now, because if I steal the lock now, I don't know what you've done. Unless I do some extra bookkeeping to handle how do I take the lock away from you, it doesn't really work. There are systems which actually do that, so database-like systems do actually implement this idea of taking locks away from things, but to do that, they need to do bookkeeping so they can undo any partial operation and redo it later. And we also need to have a circular dependency, a circular wait. We need to have your thread is waiting on some other thread, which is possibly waiting on another thread, which is eventually waiting back on yourself. So if we don't have that cycle, there's no deadlock. And this is by far the easiest way of avoiding deadlock with locks is to eliminate this problem. And we can eliminate this problem by having a consistent order in which we acquire resources. Consistent meaning every thread sort of follows the same order. And if we think about our sort of graphs of how deadlock worked, where I showed like arrows for acquiring or holding resources, you know, if we always acquire, so to have one of those deadlocks, we need to have a cycle in this graph, meaning that one thread acquired A then B, or something like that, and another thread acquired B then A. If they're all in the same direction, we can't have one of those cycles. So we all have the same consistent order. So choosing a consistent order is by far the most convenient way of avoiding deadlock. If we're still going to have the same locks, we just need to make sure we follow that consistently. And this is what typical OSs do to avoid deadlock with locks. That they have a programming convention that they make sure they follow. Some questions about reader-writer locks or deadlock from last time. Yes? About the homework, yeah? So the question is, the requirement in the thread pool assignment, which requires that you don't use more and more memory as tasks run and are waited for. So this is not a requirement to use a constant amount of memory. This is a requirement that, if I start and wait for a bunch of tasks, your memory should not be substantially higher than before that happened. So let's say, for example, I was using your thread pool in a web server that was like running for a month. It shouldn't be the case that if that web server starts tasks and wait for them, that after that month, you're out of memory.
Can you give an example of where it would run out of memory in the thread pool?
So the example in the assignment is that let's say you have a list of all tasks which I finished. And let's say when a task finished, you add it to that list. And you never clear that list. Like even if you wait for tasks until you stop. In that case, you're going to run out of memory eventually, even though there's not any information you actually need to keep around. And that's what you want to how you do. So it's okay. So you're going to need to keep information around about tasks which haven't run yet, and about tasks which haven't been waited for yet. We're telling you that you cannot keep information around about tasks which you finished processing. You need to find some other way of handling them.
So you only remove tasks which you waited for.
So tasks which you waited for, you can keep information around about. Yes.
But you don't keep.
You may keep information about tasks which have not been waited for yet.
Okay.
That is not part of the, because the requirement is, and they are waited for, is part of the requirement for that reason. But you cannot, you should not be keeping information about tasks which have already been waited for, so there's no operation you're supposed to be doing with them anymore. That answer questions? Other questions? Okay. So we talked about deadlock, mentioned our most important method is this lock order. And really, people just have convention, like just are consistent about their lock order. That's how they typically solve the problem. So that finishes up our coverage of synchronization. And our next topic is going to be about virtual memory. This is kind of an awkward topic because of the prereqs for this course. So there's three different courses you could have taken here before this course. There's CS3330, which typically, maybe not with every instructor, covers virtual memory for several days. There's COA 2, which was the pilot version of Computer Systems and Organization 2, which covers virtual memory for several days. And then there's what the computer engineering requirement is. And the prereq for this class in computer engineering is the embedded class. There's also a computer engineering architecture class, but that is not the prereq for this class. It is typically taken in the fourth year. Some people may or may not have it who are computer engineers. And my understanding is there's typically less coverage of virtual memory in those classes. So unfortunately, we have an uneven background among our students in 4414. So for that reason, please don't be disturbed if maybe you know different amounts or different things about virtual memory than your classmates from your prior courses. That's going to happen. Also means I'm going to have to do some review of virtual memory. I have to do that review because, well, even people who've taken courses where I'm pretty sure we've covered a bunch of virtual memory seem to have trouble remembering that because it hasn't come up in a while. So it's important to do the review anyways, but it's also because some people haven't seen very much of this material or seen it in sort of a very cursory way, relatively speaking. So that's just a note on prereqs. And so especially if you have less coverage, like it's not bad that you don't, you might not have seen things that people next to you have. That's common. Okay, so virtual memory is the most common mechanism for address translation. So we mentioned address translation is where we're going to translate addresses programs use to real addresses. And this allows us to give the illusion that two programs sort of have independent memory. That address 1000 in program A can map to a completely different thing than address 1000 in program B. And that's controlled by the OS. The OS sets this mapping that the processor uses. And it maps what we'll call virtual addresses to real addresses in the memory, which are called physical addresses. So this mapping is set by the OS, but implemented by the processor. And virtual memory is the name for the form this mapping takes on pretty much every system you've used as a general purpose computer. So I'm gonna start, sort of go through how this works with a very small memory, so my numbers fit on the slide. I'm going to say our program's virtual addresses, the ones accessible to the program, are 10 bits. And I'm going to divide up all those possible virtual addresses, the 1,024 of them, into four units, which I'll call pages, which are of equal size. And I'm going to number those, starting with 0. And in choosing these pages, I've chosen a size which is a power of 2. So these pages are 2 to the 8 bytes, and that choice to have a power of 2 is very deliberate in what you'll see on every real system. And the reason I chose a power of 2 is because that lets me figure out that numbering from the addresses by just taking the upper bits. It's just a consequence of me choosing a power of 2. If I didn't choose a power of 2, that wouldn't be possible in like getting the numbers would be really awkward and slow. So the page number in this case, because I chose 2 to the 8, I just chop off the last 8 bits, and I get a 2-bit page number, which corresponds to that 0, 1, 2, 3 mapping we saw earlier. And I'm going to call the rest of the address the the page offsets. And the page offset we can think of as saying where in this page we are. So the bottom of this is offset 0. The middle is going to be offset 1000000, and all the way up to all ones at the end of the page. So this is how we've divided up our program addresses, and we need to map these somehow to addresses in the real memory, which we'll call physical addresses. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to divide up the physical addresses in the same way. We're going to use the same size pages. So in this case, I have more physical addresses than virtual addresses, so the addresses on the real machine are bigger than the ones the program can see. And I'm dividing up those physical addresses into chunks of the same size, 2 to the 8 bytes. And I'm going to number these in the same way, and I can use the same trick that the upper bits of the address will be the number. And the way I'm going to set my mapping is I'm just going to map whole pages of virtual memory page addresses to whole pages of physical addresses. So I'm just going to choose that, in this example, that virtual page 0 is physical page 2. Virtual page 1 is physical page 7. Virtual page 3 I've declined to map. And virtual page 2 I've declined to map. Virtual page 3 I map to physical page 0. So I've shown this mapping on the slide, but we're not actually going to be able to express the mapping to the processor as a picture. So we're going to need to express it as numbers, and we're going to make a table of those numbers. And we're going to have a table which has an entry for each possible virtual page, giving us the physical page. And this is going to be called a page table. Yes?
Why would the OS choose not to map?
So if we haven't allocated that space, would be the most common reason. Other questions? Okay, so we have this table. So we're going to represent this table in some way in the memory. So I have a table with my virtual page numbers, and I'm going to store the physical page numbers. And I need to represent that none entry, so I'm also going to add this extra bit I label as valid, which is either going to be 1 for true or 0 for false, because I can't just represent, there's no dummy physical page number I can use, so I need an extra bit for that. And we'll see that x86 Intel will call this, and xv6 will call this present, but that means the same thing. So this is the information I'm going to supply to the processor, and the processor is going to take this address, this address from the program, it's going to split it up and look up the appropriate row of this table. It's going to see if it's valid, and if not, it's going to trigger an exception, saying the program accessed memory that wasn't set up. And we're going to also extract the physical page number and combine that with the original page offset. Because we're mapping whole pages to whole pages, if I have a virtual address that's at the start of a page in virtual addresses, it's going to be at the start of a page in the physical addresses. So I'm going to keep the page offset the same. And we have some names for things here. So the thing we look up is called a page table entry. The index we use to look it up, we'll call it the virtual page number. That's the page number part of the virtual address. The thing we get and use in the physical address, that's the page number, is the physical page number. And as before, the rest of the address, in either case, is the page offset. Questions about this simple lookup? So let's do a little exercise. So on 32-bit x86, as used by xv6, we have 4,096 byte pages, or 2 to the 12 byte pages. Remember, it's going to be a power of 2, so we can just use the upper bits to get the page number. So given that, given this address, I'm asking, what's the virtual page number? What's the page offset? And let's say I look up a page table entry, and I get this physical page number. What's my physical address going to be? And something that may be helpful to remember is that each hex digit corresponds to 4 bits. Each hex rated corresponds to 4 bits. Who'd like some more time? Okay, can someone tell me about the virtual page number part? Any, no volunteers? Yeah. Okay, A, B, C, D, 0, how do you get that? So you said these last three numbers are the page offset. And how did you determine that it was going to be 3, not some other number?
Because it's 2 to the 12 byte, or
2 to the 12 byte pages, yeah.
Yeah, so that's going to be like 3 numbers in hexadecimal, right? Because
it's 4 bit. Okay, yeah, so this is 12, means that there's a 12 bit to get the offset, because we need 12 bits to figure out where we are in 2 to the 12 things. So, and that implies 3 hex gradients. Yeah. And so that also tells us our page offset is 0x123. So, how about the physical address? Yeah. 998123. So yeah, we're just going to combine the 12-bit page offset back with a new page number, which is going to be 998, and this is an hexadecimal. Questions about how to do this exercise? Okay, so that's that. So that tells us about splitting up addresses, but if we think of the table I showed you earlier, we have a problem that we're going to have our tables, and it's going to turn out our tables are going to have like a physical page number and also some other metadata about what type of accesses are allowed, which might trigger exceptions in cases where you try to write using a page table entry that's not marked as write okay, for example. And it looks like, well, we're going to take this number, look up in this table, get the right row, you know, get our physical page number or valid bit, and the extra information about, you know, that the processor is going to check for us. And we have 2 to the 20 entries in this table. Why 2 to the 20? Well, because we have a 32-bit address, which is divided up into a page offset and a virtual page number, and 12 of the bits are for the page offset, that gives us 20 bits left over, so there must be 2 to the 20 rows in this table. And that's really big. That's very problematically big. So we're going to need to do something to store this in an efficient way. We can't just like have it be in the processor. So there's two things we're going to do. So one is we're not going to keep it on the processor. It's going to be kept in memory. And to avoid this being slow, the processor is going to have special caches known as a translation look-aside buffer. And normally, we're hopefully going to use that cache to actually do the access and not do an actual lookup. The other thing is we're going to use a tree-type like data structure so we can avoid storing large regions of invalid page table entries. It's going to turn out that most programs don't actually have most of their memory allocated, so this will save us a lot of space. And in 32-bit x86, the way this tree looks like, it's a two-level tree, so it's not a very, it's a very wide tree. And we have what we'll call a first-level page table and a second-level page table. So the first-level page table is what the OS points the processor to, and it's going to have entries for ranges of virtual page numbers. In the case of 32-bit x86, we're going to have 2 to the 10 entries. So we're going to divide, use the, it turns out, the first 10 bits of our virtual page number to figure out what row we are in the first-level page table. And those entries are going to point to a second level table. The way we're going to save space is that if we aren't using a whole range of virtual page numbers, we just will have a blank entry for the second level table and the first level, an invalid entry, that is. So our first level table, we're going to have an entry for each of these ranges of virtual page numbers. We'll have our valid bit. We'll also have extra metadata bits about whether it's accesses are allowed in user mode or write access and other things we'll see later. And the physical page number, but that's not the physical page number where the program actually has its data or code, it's the physical page number where the second level table is. So we'll use this, for example, let's say we're accessing address 0xC01, we'll say, oh, that's this entry here, and I need to go to this physical page. So in that physical page, I will find another page table, and if I want C01, I'll go to the second entry, and there I will find the actual physical page number where the program's data or code is. If I try to look up an address that's invalid, so let's say I look up address 500, then I'll look here and I'll say, oh, it's invalid, and I'll just stop my access and trigger an exception, tell the OS, hey, this program tried to access something that you didn't set up. What do you want to do about it? And here I've numbered, I've labeled like what virtual page number things are for, but the way this table is going to work is that this first entry here will be the first entry in the table at the beginning, and the second, and so on. So it's just going to be an array of entries. And we know that because it was pointed to by the fourth entry in the first level table, that the array of entries is for virtual page numbers starting with C00. Questions about this two-level design? Yes?
Is it possible to have like a write bit be set on one level and then on another level not be set?
Question, is it possible to have a write bit be set on one level and another level not be set? So yes, because the page tables are just memory contents, so you can put whatever you want there, even if it doesn't make sense, and the processor has to do something. The way XP6 is going to work is XP6 is going to always set the user and write bits at the first level and use the second level to control things most generally. As for what processors would typically do is typically they'll set things up so the first level will, so they'll take the most restrictive combination. Other questions? Okay, so a brief note on naming. You might have seen other names for things. So I'm going to call what the page table based register points to, the first level page table, or the top level page table, or there's the term that Intel uses that's also in the x86 source code, which is page directory. And the first level page table entries are going to point to another page table, which I'm going to call the second level page table, or there's the very confusing term that Intel and the x86 source code use, which is page table. So Intel had this idea that we'll call the first level page table page directory, second level page table. This idea probably didn't work out so great when they moved in 64-bit x86 to 4 or 5 level page tables. Naming kind of gets a little weird there, but that's the naming you're going to see in the x86 source code. So the first level is sometimes going to be called a page directory, with the second level just called page table. Unfortunately, terms for this aren't entirely consistent. Okay, so we have our two-level table. We use the first 10 bits of the virtual page number to look up in the first table, which is the page directory, you might see that name, and the second 10 bits for the second level. And the remaining 12 bits are where on the page we are. And x86 has code to deal with this. So in mmu.h, x86 has some macros for doing page table lookup related things. So mention that the address is split up in this way. So x86 has a macro pdx for getting the page directory index. We're getting that first 10 bits of the virtual page number just by doing some bit manipulation. And the same thing for getting the page table index, the second 10 bits, the second level lookup number. And also something for constructing an address from the index using all set. This is because x86 is going to need to set up page tables and manipulate page tables, and we're going to talk a bunch, mostly next time probably, about the code for doing that. So we have this two-level lookup. So let's start a little exercise. So let's say I have this virtual address, and I'm telling you what happens in the lookup. Lookup, we have a base pointer, meaning the address of the first level page table is 1000, and that's a byte address. So that's not a page number, that's the actual, first byte. And when I look up in the first level page table entry, I get physical page number 0x14. The second level, I get physical page number 0x15. And I'm asking, okay, given that that's what happens, what was the physical address of the first level page table entry and the second level page table entry? Give you minute to work that out. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, can someone tell me how to start getting the physical address of the first bubble? Entry. Any volunteers? Yes.
I took the first 10 bits from the virtual memory address.
Okay.
And then added those to the base pointer.
Okay, so we have our first 10 bits, and you added that to the base pointer?
Yeah.
Okay, so plus this. So this is very close. There's something something tricky I didn't go over very well, which is the effect of this. So our page table entries are more than one byte, and they kind of have to be because our page number, right? Like, well, these page numbers fit in one byte, but in general, like, they're bigger. So what that means is if we think of our page table, if this entry here is at address 0x1000, this entry is not at address 1001. But it's instead at address 0x1004. So we need to take that into account.
Multiply by 4.
So we multiply by 4. So plus that number times 4. And notice that, unfortunately, x86 couldn't manage to make everything align with the hexadecimal representation, so you can't just read off the hex digits to find that. You're going to need to do a bit of bit manipulation. Some questions? So it probably should do the actual math here. So this is going to be 4, 8, 4. So this is 0x48 times 4. And when we make it by 4, we actually just replace these add two zeros at the end. So it turns out to be 0x121120. So questions, not answer. Okay, so how about the second level? Anyone tell me how to start there? Yes. Second level, you wouldn't need to multiply by 4? No, we still have the same problem that if I know here that this entry here is at, you know, 0x10,000, this one is not at 10,001, because there's still 4 bytes. So I still have to multiply by 4.
But doesn't the page table entry give you, like, a direct page offset? So why would we multiply the page table entry?
The page table entry doesn't give us the page offset. The page offset is going to be coming from the original address.
Oh, okay.
So it's just passed through kind of beside the lookup. And in this exercise, I didn't actually ask what the actual place we access would be, which is where we'll use that page offset. Yeah.
So to get the second level page table entry, because you got a physical address on the second level page table entry, I think we could just do the same thing as the first level, except you can exchange the base pointer address with your hand suit.
Exchange the base pointer. So we're going to do the same process, plus blank times 4. Okay.
Okay, and so instead of using the base pointer address of 1000, you use 1120.
112. So, okay, so you want to use this as the base address. So this is the location where we found this contents. So this is not the page. So this address 1120, it's the address of the table entry. So it's the address of one of these. So it doesn't actually have the table, or I should go to, sorry, I should do, it's the address of, yeah, one of these. So it doesn't actually have the table for the second level. We have to go somewhere else for that. It's telling us where to go. Does that make more sense? But this is a very common confusion to bring up. So we're going to use this, and we're going to use this to find this 0x1 to 5. And that's going to be how we're going to get that base. Yes?
Should it be the 0x14?
Oh, sorry, 0x14, yes. We're going to use the first level entry, which I, this is the address of the first level entry. Remember what question we were answering? Get that, and the second level entry is going to get the 0x15. Thank you for that correction. Okay. So we're going to use this 0x14 to get the base. And the 0x14 is a page number. But we want to be consistent. We want the actual address of the first part of that page. So we're going to have to add on a page offset. So we're going to get 0x14 and 3 zeros. 3 zeros being 12 bits of zeros, our page offset size. This is, we're going from, if we think of here, we're going from 1 to 1000000. Just doing that translation to make the units work. Okay, how about the second part? What are we multiplying by 4? Where do we get that? Yeah. Second 10 bits. So I conveniently wrote out enough of the address. So these 10 bits, which ends up being 345. So this is 0x345 times 4. So questions? How that lookup worked? Yeah.
So how exactly do we know to add 3 zeros?
How do we know that there are 3 zeros? Because I'm told this is a page number. But to get a physical address, which is presumably the address of a particular byte, I need to convert that to a byte number. And I'm told it's a page number because that's what PPN stands for, page number.
And why is it 3 zeros per byte?
Why is it 3 zeros? Because I have 2 to the 12 byte pages, which means that which implies I have 12 bit page offsets. And we learned earlier that 12 bits is 3 hexadecimal. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that's that exercise. So let's do a different question. So let's say I have a process with one valid page. How big are its page tables? And let's say I have all the pages valid. How big are those page tables? Okay, who can tell me, let's go for the first part. Can tell me how many page table, how big are the page tables for one 4K page? Anyone? So we have this two-level page table structure. We have a first level that can point to second levels. So there's two things we want to know. So one is sort of how big are each of these boxes? Someone tell me that. Each of these, each page tables at each level, how big are those? Yeah. To the 12 bytes. So how did you get that?
Each entry is 4 bytes, and we have 2 to the 10 entries.
Bytes times 2 to the 10 entries, yes. Now, mind you, some of those entries might be invalid, but that still doesn't mean they take up less space, so it's 2 to the 12 bytes. Okay, so then the question is, how many of these boxes do we have in each of these scenarios? So anyone with the, or one valid page. What is that going to look like? No volunteers. Okay. So in the one valid page case, we need to have a first level because, well, we have to start somewhere. And to have that valid page, one of the entries in the first level better be valid. And that's going to have to point to a second level. So we're going to choose one of these entries to be valid. It's going to point to a second level. And that second level is still going to have that whole 2 to the 10 entries. And one of those 2 to the 10 entries is going to be valid. And it's going to point to the actual valid data. So we have 2 times 2 to the 12 bytes, or 2 pages, as it happens. 2 different ways of writing it. Questions on how I got that? Yeah.
Do you know that you have 2 to the 12 pages? If you just say, like, you know they're going to be layered, if you just say 2 times the number, the size of the pages?
So it happens in this case that page tables are the size of a page. This is because x86 designed it that way, but that's not always the case. They could have chosen to divide up the addresses in a way where that didn't happen. The most common place you'll see this in practice is sometimes, like let's say I had 40-bit addresses, like I just can't divide them up to do that. And so I won't in those systems. Does that answer your question? But since it happens to be the size of a page, yeah, we just do that. Other questions? Okay, so I have my. So how about our for all the pages populated? So, what does that look like in our diagram here? So how many entries do we have in the that are valid in the first level then? Yes. Yeah, so we're going to have, in that case, 2 to the 10 entries that are valid, the maximum possible number. So all of them are going to be valid. So we're going to have all of these, and so this is going to be x 2 to the 10, which means we have 2 to the 10 of these second level page tables, each of which happens to be one page size, or 2 to the 12 bytes. Okay, so our final answer is then we're going to have 2 to the 10 plus 1 for the first level times 2 to the 12 bytes, or 2 to the 10 plus 1 pages worth of space. Some questions, how I figured that out? Okay. So talk generally about how page tables work in 32-bit XV6. Let's talk about some things that XV6 does. So in XV6, we have this memory layout here, which I think I may have briefly shown before, and it's divided into two pieces. We have the blue part, which is for the kernel only, and the green part, which is for user mode. And these are split halfway through, so address 8000000, halfway through the 32-bit space. And this is a constant called kern base in the XV6 code. And the kernel part of memory has this very simple correspondence to physical memory, and this is how XV6 sets up the page tables to make this happen, and that the address at kern base corresponds to address 0, kern base plus 1, kern address 1, kern base plus 1,000, address 1,000, kern base plus 10,000, address 10,000, and so on. There's a one-to-one mapping in the blue region. And this makes it convenient for the kernel to access a particular physical address, which sometimes it needs to do. In the user part, well, this memory is set up to be convenient for the user program. So this mapping is going to be just dependent on what was useful to allocate to the program. And one thing this means is that all this stuff in the user area of memory, the green part, is going to have a mapping that's all duplicated by one of the mappings in the kernel part. That's fine. That's allowed. There's nothing preventing you from having two page table entries that specify the same physical page. And the green one is going to be what the user programs use to access that memory, and the blue one is what the kernel uses when it's looking things up based on physical addresses. So questions about sort of this mapping generally, and that we have this sort of double, two ways of accessing data in the user's memory, of the way the user can use and the way that the kernel sets up just as a simple static mapping. Okay, so we have that. And this mapping is going to be stored in the page table. So XV6 is going to set up these page tables to store that mapping and to maintain this mapping. Okay, so we have that mapping. So we have these two mappings, the program memory part that has the layout programs expect. The kernel code is going to have lots of places, especially when we're making up page tables, setting up page tables where we need to quickly access a particular physical page. So let's look at the program part of memory. So this is the layout that XV6 uses for programs, and this might look a little different than what you're used to in that our stack is below our heap. And the heap is above and grows up towards the beginning of the kernel. The stack pointer starts at the top of the stack and goes down into this thing called the guard page I'll talk about next. We also have the data. This is global variables and text, which is another name for code of the program. Sorry, you got address 0. So that is, even though that would be a null pointer. So XV6, this is a little different than what you're used to, especially in that the stack is in the middle because it simplifies XV6 memory management a little bit. Questions about this besides the guard page? Since I'll talk about the guard page next. Okay, so we have this guard page, which is after the stack, and it's what the stack grows toward. So as we add things to the stack pointer goes down, and eventually we'll hit the guard page. The guard page is deliberately marked in the page tables as kernel mode only. It's not accessible in user mode. So when a program tries to expand its stack into the guard page and tries to read or write from there, it will trigger an exception. And XV6 can cause the program to crash. And the idea of this is to churn stack overflows from doing something weird to consistently crashing, hopefully. Because if we didn't have the guard page, well, what would stack overflows do? Well, they'd go into this data here and overwrite things, and that would probably make the program behave very weirdly. in a very hard to debug way relative to just crashing from having from accessing the guard page. Okay, some questions about the guard page? Okay, so XV6 has a bunch of code that sets up page tables and deals with memory. And there's this convention in the code. We're going to look at a bunch of the functions for the remaining 15 minutes and next time. So for virtual addresses, you'll see XV6 use pointers, like void stars. And when we're dealing with physical addresses, XV6 will use ints. This is just a convention to make it so the people who are writing the XV6 code know whether it's a physical or virtual address. And XV6 also has these functions for converting from physical to virtual addresses that are based on that one-to-one mapping. So these functions only work for addresses for that blue region, that kernel part of memory. If you want to figure out how to convert a user program address to a physical address, you need something more complicated. These functions are just macros for adding and subtracting that 800 to do that one-to-one mapping we saw earlier. So VTP will take a virtual address that's in that blue region and convert it to the physical address by subtracting. P2V will take a physical address and convert it to a virtual address from the blue region. Yes. And versus an address that could be accessed in user mode in the green area. That would be correspond to part of this. So all these addresses aren't dealt with by P2V, VTP. It's just stuff up here. That's kernel only. The green, we don't have to do something else. And the reason why is because for the stuff up here, the translation is just subtraction because of the one-to-one mapping. For the stuff down here, we have to look up what's in the page table. And that's a lot more complicated. So questions on that? So we have a user address. We need to do a real page table lookup to figure out how to translate virtual to physical. If we have a physical address and want the user address, we have to scan through the page tables to find it, which is really complicated and inefficient. Okay, and I mentioned when dealing with paging, we have to deal with virtual and physical addresses. So another thing we have to deal with is page table entries. So XV6 has two aliases for unsigned int for dealing with page table entries. So page table entries are just 32-bit numbers that are going to be encoded in a particular way. But for the convenience in the XV6 kernel to keep track of what they're dealing with, they'll call first level page table entries the user type PDE for page directory entry, and second level use the PTET for page table entry. But these are just aliases for unsigned int. And we can treat the page tables at the first or second level as just arrays of unsigned ints, which is what the XV6 code will do. So how are these unsigned ints encoding things? Because remember we told you that page table entries have a physical page number, a valid bit, and a bunch of extra metadata bits. So the format is determined by the processor. And this is from Intel's documentation. It shows the format of page table entries and also the format of the page table base register, the special register we set to say where the first level page table is. And we have the address of the first level page table, as Intel calls it, a page directory. This is actually just the page number. And we also have some extra metadata bits here and some stuff that's ignored. In our first level page table entries, we actually have two different choices for formats, or three different possible formats, only the last two of which will be relevant to us. So we have this valid bit, which is our least significant bit. So if the page table entry is invalid, this least significant bit is zero, which Intel calls not present, and you'll see this in the XV6 code, then we set the valid bit, the present bit, to zero, and the rest of the page table entries ignored by the processor. Otherwise, If it's 1, we have our address, our physical page number, in these upper 20 bits. And we also have some metadata bits. Most notably, we have a writable bit and a user mode accessible bit. Those are the ones we're going to be actually paying attention to. The others mostly aren't going to matter for us. And we have a similar format for our second level page table entries here. If it's not present, everything's ignored. Otherwise, we have this present valid bit, present slash valid bit, and these metadata bits and the physical page number at the top. Some questions about this format here? Yeah. What's the difference between the second, this row and this row?
Yeah.
So this first row is for, Intel has support for large pages. So pages which are more than 4K, even though most pages are 4K, and that's what the second row is for. This is not a feature that XV6 uses. And you can see that they use this metadata bit here to distinguish which version we're using. Other questions? Okay, so something you'll notice about this page table format is that Intel decided to stuff the physical page number in the upper 20 bits, and this is a very useful decision because if we think of how physical addresses work, the way we take a physical address take a physical page number and convert it to the physical address of a page is we take the physical page number and add a bunch of zeros onto it. And it happens to be the exact same number of zeros that are left after the physical page number of the page table entries. So what we can do is we can take this page table entry and replace all these extra metadata bits with zeros, and we get the physical address of the beginning of that page. Very nice. And also, we can construct a page table entry by taking the physical address of a page and ORing it with the extra bits we want to send, which I'll call flags. And this is going to be very convenient when we're manipulating page table entries, and you'll see this in the XV6 code that actually does that. So XV6 has read these processor manuals and sort of copied the information about what parts of the page table entry are where. So we have these flags. We have our present or valid flag bit, which is at the end, bit 1. We have writable, we have accessible in user mode, and all of these other bits. We're going to be almost entirely concerned with these. The others, they just copied from the manual in case they want to use them, but it turns out they basically don't. They also have a macro for taking a page table entry, zeroing out all the flag bits to get the address from it, called pteouter. Just zeroes them all out, gets the physical address. And also something for getting only the flags if they want that. So removing the address part. Okay, so questions? So with this in mind, here's how we could sort of manually extract a page table, as we're going to do a top level, a first level page table entry. So let's say I have a process P, I have the struct proc for it, and I have the virtual address I want to extract things for. So I can get the top level page table. It's the pager entry in the struct proc. There's a pointer to that first level page table. And remember earlier I said that XV6 had this macro PDX, which gets the index in the first level table. So we're going to use that on the address to get that index. And I just use that as part of an array lookup. And since the way array lookups work in C, remember, it takes care of scaling by the size of the thing in the array, which is 4 bytes. So that's going to be that multiplying by 4 plus a base we saw earlier. So that's going to be done here. And we get the actual page table entry. And I can figure out if flags are set using bitwise apt. So in this case, I say, is it marked as present, meaning valid? Is it marked as writable? Is it marked as user accessible? I can just decode that by anding to check each of those bits. And I can use this PT adder to get the physical address of the page where the second level page table entry, second level page table it points to is. So questions? What's going on in this code that manipulates page table that reads from the first level page table? Okay. And we can kind of apply the principle I said of ORIN flags with addresses to construct page table entries. So if we have a page table pointer, we can access it like an array, setting a particular entry in it, and we can construct an entry, construct that number by ORing the flags together with the base address that we want it to point to, which would be the address of a second level table if it was an entry in the first level table, or the address of the actual user code or data if it was in the second level table. Questions? Yes. Okay, so in XV6, we're going to talk sort of as our next topic, probably mostly next time, about a bunch of functions XV6 has for manipulating page tables. We're going to look at what they are and how they work. So one thing is XV6 needs a way of allocating memory, so it has a function called kalloc and a corresponding function called kfree, which allocates physical pages. We have a function to get a pointer to a second level page table entry. So generally, we're going to show how that works, but generally we're not going to do that manual page table lookup. XV6 code is generally going to call this function to handle the page table lookup process called walk page derp. We have map pages, which is going to set a bunch of page table entries. And the way map pages work in most of the XV6 functions that manipulate page tables is it calls walk page dir to get pointers to page table entries and sets them. It just does that in a loop to set up a range of page table entries. We have allocKVM and allocUVM. So allocKVM handles creating page tables with that one-to-one mapping. So when we make a new process, we need to set up that one-to-one mapping. AllocKVM is the function which does that. So it's just basically a bunch of calls to map pages to set up those mappings. We have AllocUVM, which handles allocating the user part of memory. So that this is going to, again, be a loop around the walk page or map pages that just sets up that green part of memory according to how much space we need to allocate. And we have a corresponding deallocate, which just unsets them and frees up the memory, probably using kfree. So we'll look through how these functions work next time, starting with walk page dir, which is the sort of most important. So most of the other functions are relatively straightforward, just using walk page dir over and over again. So questions on sort of these general utility functions or page table format? Okay. So I guess we'll leave it there. See you next week.